Welcome, one and all, to the podcast dedicated to exploring the vast media landscape in search of its finest creatives. I'm Darren, your host. Welcome to Heroes of the Mediascape. My featured guest today is podcaster, sports enthusiast, musician, and educator, Lance Laster. How's it going, man?
Going pretty well. I like that description of me. I think that you covered all the bases there.
Thank you. You know, I spent way too much time working on it. So quick cold question here to start off, Lance. Mm-hmm. What led you to becoming a podcaster? Why not choose just becoming a YouTuber or starting like a blog or a vlog?
I guess the answer is Zach Moore. So
fair enough.
Because I've been doing this for a while, and more than just, you know, my appearance and many appearances on his show, Always Hold Up Smallville, but we had another one back in the before times that we did. And that ran for a little bit. And so, I don't know, he asked me, he was like, hey, do you think this is cool? You want to try and do it? And I was like, yeah, sure, why not? And we had a little bit of a following. We just kind of talked about random stuff. And then after that, he kind of he got the idea to do Smallville, doing something like very focused rather than very broad like we were doing. And then obviously it helped with that. So I think the main answer is him. The second answer to that would be, I guess it was easier to do podcasting rather than stuff with video at the time when we started doing all this stuff, before YouTube really kind of took over and before YouTubers were a thing and monetizing and all that other type of stuff. I think we probably thought it was too much of a hassle and too much extra work to do the video stuff. And I think we probably figured that podcasting was easier, just audio only, and then just kind of keeping it there.
That's fair. What was that show called?
Nerds Explain It All.
Nerds Explain It All.
Yep.
Sounds about right.
Yep. And so I think the issue with that one was it was myself, Zach, and another friend of ours from high school. But with that show, I think the main issue was it was just not as focused as other things can be, because that concept, and you know, with as far as the name of the show is concerned, there's a lot of things that can go under that umbrella, and not all three of us were into the same thing nerd wise. We each had our niche things, and not all of us, I guess, were served in that regard, because like each of us had specific likes and dislikes, and sometimes we would do something that we all kind of really weren't into, but it was just because it was falling under that umbrella. But also just the fact that it was not as focused of a show kind of made it harder to do. So I think that's one of the reasons why that kind of went by the wayside. But okay. It's out there somewhere.
Nice. So how long would you say in total have you been podcasting for?
Well, we started that was 2012, 2013. So since then.
Wow. That's like almost like literally right when Smallville got done.
Yeah, basically. And that's kind of when I got into listening to podcasts, honestly, because I had a long commute to work at the time, you know, aside from just listening to, you know, regular sports radio here in Houston or music. I got into listening to various podcasts. And at the time, a favorite was the Kevin Smith Batman on Batman podcast, the Modern Myth Media podcast back in the day, and a couple of others. That's kind of what got us into it, because like we were listening to all these shows, and then the idea was like, hey, let's do our own.
I'll have to go check that out afterwards. So
it's us in the before times.
Yeah, just to see how different, like, you know, how things were back then compared to they are now. And
yeah, we are, you know, pretty much the same, but we were definitely younger, and you'll be able to tell that.
That's awesome. I can't wait. You know, speaking of previous podcasting experience, segue, you and I have obviously podcasted together in the past a number of times. Some of my favorite podcasting experiences, I might add.
Well, that's cool. That's good to hear.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, mainly because of you, obviously. But
appreciate it.
But, you know, like we obviously have recorded a couple of different episodes on my own podcast, Round 2, mm-hmm. the film sequel podcast. We covered Rocky 2 and Rocky 3. Mm-hmm. What would you say is your favorite Rocky movie?
Probably 3. I'd say 3 is like, but the thing is, I don't know. I love them all, even Rocky 5. The Rocky movies, that's my favorite film franchise, is the Rocky franchise. And I think it's probably the most successful and the best at doing and honoring the legacy of what they started, and having really decent continuity throughout. Everything makes sense. The character motivations and where they take the story all make sense in pretty much all of them. And you still get the same emotional weight and drama, and it all ends up concluding in a very, you know, wise and fulfilling way each time. So, but of my favorite of the Rockies, probably three. If I had to give you an answer right now,
it's probably the most fun one to watch, I would say, right?
Yeah, it's that, but also like it. I think it's also the most rewarding to watch because like, you have the high stakes of you're coming off the high stakes of two and one, and then it's just like, well, how are we going to top that in three? And the payoff and the key to everything, as we've discussed on your podcast, is the team up between Rocky and Apollo. That's like, it's so genius looking back on it, but like, and looking at it now. But back then, I'm pretty sure, you know, that one must have blew people's minds. It's like, no way. The two rivals are going to fight together, or are going to like work together to take down this other thing. It's such a novel and easy concept, but it works so brilliantly in this franchise. So, and that's exciting.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's definitely one of my top favorites as well. I mean, I'd like you, there are no bad Rocky movies. Even Rocky V is enjoyable in a sense, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it's not the same, obviously. And maybe some would argue even Rocky Balboa to a certain degree for different reasons. But yeah, I feel like there's not there's not a bad, you know, like Rocky V is not Superman IV, The Quest for Peace. You know what I mean?
Correct.
Like, which, yeah. Even that's that the movie thing. I enjoy as well. But like,
yeah,
you know, that's just kind of, yeah. You know, so anyway, speaking of Apollo Creed teaming up with Rocky, mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on the Creed franchise, the spinoff that they started? Now that I think they've done at least three films, right? If not,
they've done three.
A fourth probably on the way.
Maybe it wouldn't shock me if it ended up having the same amount of movies as Rocky. But no, I love the Creed movies, and I don't necessarily think of them as a separate franchise. I think of them as part of the Rocky franchise because again, it all blends together, and it was a brilliant way of doing legacy and doing these movies again, especially considering that you have Rocky training Apollo. Again, the circle keeps going, and like in finding new, as you keep going around, you get new checkpoints within the circle here. And then you have, you know, spoilers, he fights Drago's kid in the sequel, which is like, mind blown because again, it's so simple and so easy. It's like, duh, of course you're going to do that, but it's still exciting. And you have those characters meeting again after, you know, at that point, after 40 years, you had Dolph Lundgren and Rocky have a scene together, and that was electric. That was cool. And then you have three, where it's a different type of challenge, not necessarily related to Rocky specifically, but it's the third one is definitely more Creed than Rocky. But the whole thing, again, if the starting point of this whole, you know, universe, this cinematic universe, starts with the 70s Rocky film all the way through Creed 3. So, I mean, we could keep doing these. It's very possible. They made a comic book about Creed's daughter, because he has a daughter in the movies, and she's a teenage fighter, and going through that whole thing. And again, it's just more continuation of the story and these characters, and it's good stuff. If they came out with that movie, I'd be first in line to see it.
Absolutely, totally with you, totally agree. And just the way that they expanded this franchise into bringing the Creed movies, how they came about, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, I thought was so brilliant as well.
I agree. And they had the right people to do it. Again, they had the right star at the right time to carry this out. And I mean, you can't really go wrong with Michael B. Jordan. So,
yeah, absolutely. And then obviously pairing him with Sylvester Stallone and mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, you know, hashtag it's all connected. You know?
Hashtag it is all connected.
Speaking of Zach Moore, but you know, and since we're on the topic of sports movies, I always enjoyed listening to your other podcast, Training Montage. Back in the day.
Yeah, that was fun. That was definitely a product of its time, and by product of its time I mean the COVID time,
right?
We had a lot of time to do things. That's why, you know, I ended up taking on another one. But then, you know, as the world opened up, the two of us had like we had to get back into the world to do stuff, and it's like that left that time that extra time that we had did no longer existed. So but no, that was fun.
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's definitely fair. No, I'm with you. That was quite an interesting time. And all of a sudden everyone's at home with all this time on their hands and you put it to good use.
You know, it's better to stay busy rather than idle. So
yes.
Good busy is better than the alternative.
Amen to that. So, you know, while we're on the topic of these sports movies and your other podcast, what would you say, maybe other than the Rocky movies, is the gold standard for like a sports movie or TV show? Like, what would you say is the gold standard for that?
That's a tough question, because I have a lot of favorites within this, within that sports movie genre. Like, you know, I love Remember the Titans. I think that's a good example. Like, it's a quintessential, you know, sports movie. I love The Sandlot, very much similar. In a lot of ways, The Sandlot's a perfect movie. You have TV show, Friday Night Lights is a favorite through all its flaws and warts. I love that show. I'm also kind of obsessed with Friday Night Lights just in general. Like, I read the book that everything was based off of. Obviously seen the movie many times, and I'm a huge fan of the show. Seen that through and through. That book's a hard read, by the way. It's not just about the football team, which I did not know when I started reading that book. Same I don't know here. If you have or not. Yeah,
yep, so, same here.
Yeah, so like I was with like, the opening chapters are more about like, you know, Reagan era economics in small towns. That threw me for a loop. I was like, this is, again, I was in college at the time. So it's just like, this feels like I'm reading like a textbook, like for a class that I have to do a paper on, rather than like, I wanted to hear about Coach Gaines and all this other stuff. So yeah. So Friday Night Lights is his favorite. And then like my favorite movie of all time is Jerry Maguire, which you can argue it's a sports movie. You can argue that it's a rom-com. You can argue that it's a mixture of both, or you can make the argument that it's only one of those things. But it, you know, so those are my go-tos in a lot of ways. It's hard to find like a quintessential one, because there's so many good ones. Rudy's one, you know, just kind of thinking of like Hoosiers, like thinking of the other things that are just kind of like, you know, running out the top of the list. Major League, and you know, a lot of fighting ones. I will say that it's hard to do basketball in these movies. Sports movie for basketball is hard. I think it's just because basketball is hard to shoot. Fictitiously, I should say.
No pun intended.
Exactly. Space Jam's a favorite. But yeah, the basketball is hard to do. But it's all, but like, I think we end up getting more out of fighting, football, and baseball.
Coach Carter.
I love Coach Carter.
It's a good one.
Yeah, we did that on my other podcast, just because we had one of the stars in that movie.
That's awesome. Yeah, I never thought of it that way. Like basketball, like is hard to capture, you know?
Yeah, fictitious, because it's like it's hard to set up like shots for things. You know, again, no pun intended, but like, and how to script the action, because you don't know how it's like. You could run the play, but you can miss the shot, right? And like with baseball, you could superimpose like, you know, hitting the ball, which is interesting, because like that's the hardest thing to do in sports is hit a baseball. But that is easier to do in film and stage, because your position players are stationary for the most part, or relatively stationary. So it's easy to film because you know exactly where they're going to be, and you can set up the you know, the cameras accordingly to make sure that you get them in their spots. Same thing with football. They start off stationary before going into action, but that action can be replicated more times and easier than it can with basketball, since basketball is so improvisational, even though there are sets in it. It's weird. It's kind of a weird dichotomy how that works.
Yeah, no, I get you. You know, football is kind of like rock and roll, and basketball is kind of more like jazz, you know?
Yes.
Not Absolutely. To quote Michael Scott or anything, but.
Yeah, but it's, well, actually, Michael Scott stole that from Wynton Marsalis.
Well, there you go. See, it's all connected. What can I say? It's funny, because I actually just watched, I rewatched Air Bud the other day for the first time in many, many years.
Really?
Yeah. And I actually quite enjoyed it. You know, to be honest.
Well, that's cool. I see. I have no memory of those those, at least the first two. I know I've seen them, but I have no memory of it. I'm sure they're fun though.
Yeah, it's fun. And it's actually a lot more heartfelt than I was expecting as well.
Okay. That's
cool. It's Disney. It's on Disney Plus if people are interested in checking it out, but yeah, it was definitely fun. As in terms of like more like modern, more recent sports movies, are there any of that you have watched lately that you've either like loved or actually kind of like found pretty disappointing?
I really like the one that Adam Sandler did, like that came out a few years ago, where he's like a scout. I really like that one. I can't remember the name of it at the moment, at the top of my head, but I really like that movie. And then outside of that, the ones that I've kind of been most a fan of have been like documentaries, because we've really stepped up our sports documentary game. And granted, like the ESPN 30 for 30s, when those first started coming out, those were game changers, because we hadn't gotten, you know, sports documentaries with that level of detail and intrigue before. But then, you know, during the pandemic, when The Last Dance came out, that kind of changed everything. And now everything wants to try to be like a Last Dance type of thing, because Brady has one that's similar, and Jeter has one. A couple other people have some, and we know that this next generation, whenever they're done, they're gonna try to top those. So yeah, the sports documentaries, those have been what I've been mostly into.
Yeah, I've noticed that too. There's been a lot of them, especially on Netflix. I feel like there's been a lot of documentaries on there.
Documentaries, and also just like these shows in documentary style that kind of go through a year where you follow a handful of players, like the quarterback show and the basketball, the starting five one that recently just became a thing. But my favorite one of the Netflix of those shows is Full Swing, the golf one. That one's very interesting. And so I eagerly look forward to those every spring.
Awesome. Yeah, that's awesome. That's really cool. So yeah, if you're looking for good documentaries, you know where to find them.
Yes.
They're everywhere.
They are everywhere.
Yeah. You know, documentaries, they cover, you know, real sports teams and real players. Right. And speaking of real sports teams and real players,
okay,
I know you're a big fan of the Oakland/Las Vegas Raiders.
Yep.
That are, you know, the season's right around the corner, about to get started. What are your thoughts on the Raiders this year? Do they have a chance? Do they not have a chance like they have, like lately, last few years? Or
I don't know if have a chance is the right verbiage for this season. I think the season will definitely be interesting. I'm not going into it with like a pessimistic attitude like I have the past couple of years. And again, like it's so funny, like with your teams, especially like when they're bad, you could be honest about the expectations and you could be honest with yourself about like, look, I know that they're bad, but they're mine. So it's like, just let me have this. Let me try to enjoy them winning. And you try to not let your entire mood and mental health be dictated by their success or failure. But it's hard. But with the Raiders this year, I think they'll be interesting. We have a new coach. We have Pete Carroll, who has a good track record, except for when it comes to what to do in the fourth quarter when it's time to run the ball. And he does not do it. So, but as far outside of that, he creates a great culture. People like playing for him, and he gets results. He's a successful coach in a lot of ways. And I think he'll definitely bring a winning culture to the team. I think we'll be tougher. I think we'll be more fundamentally sound. I think we will win more. I don't think that we'll go to the playoffs this year, but I think that we'll kind of be close to a wild card spot maybe. But as far as like winning and having a chance and being like, you know, contenders, a couple of years away, I think. I still think we need a more dynamic quarterback. I like that we have Geno. It's an upgrade over what we've had. We should have never traded Derek Carr, but he's retired now, so it's kind of whatever. We have a lot of issues, the Raiders do, but I think we'll definitely be interesting, and I think we'll be competitive, and we won't be awful. I think that for this season. And anything above that will be a surprise, and I'll be happy for if it's in the positive.
Yeah, I mean, you'd be surprised how much a new quarterback and a new head coach can really change things for a team, you know?
Yeah. The defense should be better. We have Max Crosby. We have him pretty much long term. We have a breakout star in Brock Bowers at tight end. Now we have somebody that can actually get him the ball. So like all the stuff that he did last year as a rookie should be on par with this year and even more. So we'll see. We drafted the running back I wish we would have had for a long time, Ashton Jeanty, the runner up for the Heisman Trophy last year. So I think he'll be great. So we'll see if we turn out to be contenders. I will be ecstatic. I don't think we'll be contenders this year. I think it's coming later, but I don't think it'll be this year.
It's fair, you know. I think about the Raiders. I mean, they're kind of in a tough division. You really think about
in the toughest division.
Yeah.
We're in the toughest division that nobody talks about, because everybody, like every year, everybody talks about the NFC East. And
the NFC East.
Yeah, I know. And they suck. And then collectively, like, and there's always like three of them every year will suck. And one of them will be good every single year. Last year just happened to be the Eagles, you know, who, you know, I I lived in Philadelphia for a little bit. I have a soft spot for the Eagles. Happy for them. But you know, the NFC East dominates the conversation, and so does the AFC North. They dominate the conversation just because they think the people, you know, I don't know, get off on the Bengals, on the Steelers and the Ravens having a rivalry. But it's like, Steelers have been mediocre for 20 years. So they haven't done anything. Literally 20 years. They haven't won a playoff game since they won the last Super Bowl. Like, what are we doing? But our division is incredibly hard. We have the Chargers who want to come up with Harbaugh as the coach. We have the Broncos, who we thought were going to be awful, but now that they have Bo Nix and they seem to be in the right direction, moving in the right direction, especially now they have Sean Payton as their coach, that is interesting. And then, of course, we have to deal with the Chiefs.
Yep, Mahomes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's tough for everybody because it seems like they're either in the AFC Championship game or the Super Bowl every year since they've gotten Mahomes. So.
That's correct. So yeah. It's like, love them or hate them, we have to deal with them. And we have to, and I have to respect that they're just that good, because they are.
They are, yeah. And it can be frustrating. You know, like,
it's incredibly frustrating.
Like, I feel bad for like our friend Chris Fuchs, who's a really big Buffalo Bills fan.
Yes.
Bills Mafia. Shout out to Chris. Yes, shout out to Chris. And I feel like every year I'm always cheering for the Bills to finally get over the hump. Mm-hmm. And they always just fall just short, and it's usually the Chiefs. And you know, I maybe this is their year. I thought for sure it was gonna be last year, and yeah, the year before.
I thought last year was Lamar's year.
Yeah, I mean, that was a really good game, actually. That the Bills and Ravens. That was a really good playoff game.
I know. So I thought it was Lamar's year last year. He's a player, an individual player that I root for, and I thought last year was gonna be his year. And it just didn't pan out. I thought it was going to be Burrow's year a couple of years ago. Also didn't pan out. He's another player I really like.
Yeah.
But how about you? How about your Vikings? How are you feeling about J.J. McCarthy?
I'm so excited. I can't even deny it. It's been an interesting offseason because of everything that happened with Sam Darnold last year. Mm-hmm. And he had such a breakout year with Kevin O'Connell as the coach and resurrected his career after what happened with like the Jets previously and the Panthers, and it didn't go very well. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about like, especially like late in the season of like, how can you not sign this guy to be your guy? But it's tough because the Vikings had just drafted J.J. McCarthy in the first round, top 10 pick, you know? So they'd kind of invested in him. And Darnold
y'all moved up to get him too, right?
Yeah. A couple spots moved up to get him just to make sure. Cause you know, you never know. And it sounded like that was like their guy from the get go, that and the Drake May, I think, from who the Patriots got right away. But you know, it's tough to trade up into a top three spot to get a quarterback and not give up such a huge ransom to get that player. But yeah, they're obviously big on J.J. McCarthy. Kevin O'Connell seems like he's his biggest fan, which is awesome. But when Darnold played so well, it really created that conversation of like, can you really move on from someone who's, you know, it's hard to find someone who's consistent and who's really good, you know, for your team in the NFL, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it was tough. And I know he was on like he took a 1 year, like a lower deal.
Mm-hmm.
So if we would have brought him back, it would have created some cap issues and they would have had to probably part ways with certain players they probably didn't want to.
Yeah.
So that would have made it tough. But, you know, Darnold went to Seattle, you know, he got paid. Good for him. He gets, you know, a chance to prove himself over there. And then when we have JJ ready in the wings, you know, like sat out a whole year and now he's ready to go. And, you know, everything we've heard sounds promising. And what I really like with what the Vikings did in the offseason is they've really focused on really getting the good pieces around him. Like they've really solidified so much talent on the roster. They've beefed up the offensive line. They drafted an offensive lineman in the first round. They signed the two guys from the Colts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have Justin Jefferson back and Hawkinson back. We kept, you know, Aaron Jones in the backfield. You know, and we traded for the running back from the 49ers. So it's, you know, we
have
really good depth. Oh, no, I'm blanking on his name. Now I got to look this up because it's going to bother me. But no, and they've made a really good effort to keep a lot of guys on defense. You know, obviously Brian Flores was really good last year for the Vikings and really solidifying that defense and getting pressure on the quarterback. Jordan Mason is his name. He played quite a bit, I think, last year due to injuries that they had over at San Fran. But
yeah, Shanahan runs those running backs into the ground.
It's a Shanahan thing. It's been a Shanahan thing for decades and decades.
Yeah, but it's going to Father Shanahan.
Yeah. Yeah, so anyway, and KOC has obviously more than proven himself as head coach of the Vikings. So
yeah, I mean, him.
He's spent two of his first 3 years, he's won 13 games, which is with like different rosters, basically, which is
insane.
Insane. And probably the only reason it wasn't three is because Kirk Cousins got hurt the 1 year. And then it was just kind of, you know, the Josh Dobbs thing, and then it kind of snowballed after that. But there is a guy who was on the Vikings that I know you have a connection to. I know you've mentioned this before, but I would love to hear the whole story again.
Okay.
What is your connection with Case Keenum?
You mean the GOAT?
The GOAT. 2017 yeah. GOAT.
Yeah, that's correct. The NCAA all-time leader in passing, Case Keenum. So Case is a graduate of the University of Houston, as am I. When you're in college, and you root for players that are for your college team, especially at the time, at the same time you are, because you're peers, right? You're essentially peers with this person in a lot of ways. It means something different. And with him, he was our guy, right? And he was breaking all these records. He was proving himself to be the best player in college football, even though he did not get that recognition. But to us, he was. And he was the reason why we were doing all the things that we were doing positively in the football field. I remember watching him in the spring game, because I'm a little older than him. So I remember watching him spring game before his freshman year, and he wasn't even the starter. So another guy was, Blake Joseph. Shout out to Blake Joseph. But at the spring game, I was like, nah, this number seven, he is it. He makes plays. That's what he does. Like he's going out there scrambling, throwing stuff, weird angles, kind of sidearm and stuff, just completing passes, moving the stuff. Like I was like, and the offense had a quick beat about it. I was like, nah, this kid is it. And then we tried the whole, which I hate, the whole two quarterback thing for a little bit that year. And I remember because we played Oregon, and this is an infamous game because this is, I don't know if you remember this or if you've seen clips of it. You've probably seen like social media clips of it or anything, but when our mascot and the duck got in a fight, y'all can look it up. So that happened at that game, but this is Case's first start in Oregon, and he went toe to toe with them because they were like number 10 or something in the country at the time. We lost that game, but it was at that game. It was like, oh no, it's this kid. This is the one. He's the one. And he proved it, you know, the years afterwards. We got to see him, and I got to see him break records. I got to see him beat Texas Tech on that scramble, you know, back at the Rob. It coincided with a time where, like, the university was finally kind of getting some respect back, and we were, you know, filling up the place. It was an exciting time to be, a Houston Cougar fan, and he is a big part of that. And so being there for all of that just kind of made me root for him harder. And then so we were all my friends who were Cougar alumni, very invested in his career after that. And we've watched him at every single place that he's been. It was very exciting when he was on the Texans, and I'll never forget that Sunday night football game against the Colts. Ended up losing, but because Case played so well in that first half.
I remember watching that game.
Yeah. So he played so well in that first half, it gave Gary Kubiak a heart attack. Like legitimately. And so, cause Gary Kubiak had a heart attack at that game at halftime. And so that's part of the reason why they lost. The team was like, holy crap. How do you respond? Like how do you respond after that? It's like your head coach has a heart attack at halftime. Like that's nuts. But I'm somewhat facetious when I refer to him as the GOAT to people. I get a lot of laughs from a lot of people. It's like Case Keenum, but I was never wrong about him having a place in the NFL, right? Like, because even if his role right now is backup quarterback, there are like, yeah, they're the starters, but he's better than a lot of those backups, like in a lot of different places. And in a lot of places, better than starters, especially some of these people on bad teams, like they would kill to have Case Keenum as their starter. And luckily for me, as a fan of his, I've got to see a lot of his successes, and he's part of you will never not be able to say that he's a part of NFL history because of what happened with Minnesota. Right. And so being able to pull that off, that pass to Diggs to win that game, and all the images and everything that comes from that, like, he will forever have a place in NFL history for that. They will play that highlight forever, and it will be on NFL films forever, that thing. And he'll be an answer to a trivia question. And I love that for him.
Yeah, that was such a fun year to be a Vikings fan, I will say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially
he almost went to the Super Bowl. Like,
yeah,
like, man, like, I know myself, it's probably for the best that he did not go, because I was going to be very annoying if Case Keenum went to a Super Bowl and won one. Like, so,
well, you know, and fun fact, that Super Bowl is actually in Minnesota.
I know.
So I know y'all could have had a
home. Yeah, it could have been a home Super Bowl. That would have been amazing.
Yeah. But, you know, and for the first drive of that NFC Championship game against the Eagles, he throws a touchdown pass to Kyle Rudolph. Yep. Opening drive.
Yep.
And we're like, all right, we've got this. Like, yep, here we go, you know?
Yep.
And the rest of the game was really, really painful to watch.
It was. Yeah. And the funny thing is, I was living in Philadelphia at the time, and a lot of my Philly friends were giving me a lot of crap because I was talking a lot of crap, because I was like, look, y'all are playing the GOAT. Like, because they knew I was from Houston. They knew I love Case. And so it was this interesting situation where I'm rooting hard for Case in a city in Philadelphia, of all places to be rooting against the Eagles at the time. So
yeah,
it was a very fun watch. And of course, they were scared. And like, after that first touchdown, like, when he went down there, they were like, oh, because they were probably thinking, Nance was probably right about this guy. I was like, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was funny because I remember, I think Eagles played the Falcons the week before, and that game was really close. And I think it came down like right to the end of the game, and they had like a like a defensive stop.
Yeah.
Like inside the red zone.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that could have been a very, very different. Wow. It would have actually been a rematch, the Falcons and Vikings in the championship game. Mm-hmm. Yeah. 98.
Would have been a rematch.
I think the Vikings would have definitely won that.
That one matchup. Yes, that matchup. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. But yeah, Philadelphia was just, if you look at that team, that was probably the most stacked team ever.
It was, it's kind of nuts. If
you look at it, you know?
It was kind of nuts. The only thing that they weren't stacked at was quarterback. Because you have to remember, like, they put all their eggs in the Carson Wentz basket. And it's kind of crazy to see. Like, you think about that now, and, like, he's out of the league, basically. It was Nick Foles that brought him home.
Yeah, and you know what? To his credit, I mean, he was unstoppable.
He was.
You know?
Good for him.
He played so poorly during the regular season, like filling in for Wentz, and everyone's like, oh man, the Eagles are going to be one and done. They're going to be one and done. And then you look what he did, and even in the Super Bowl, he was just incredible.
He was lights out.
Know? Yeah. And then I know he's kind of had a roller coaster career too, which is kind of...
Yeah, but he has, again, kind of like with Case in those moments, he has those moments, but bigger ones. He has the Super Bowl. He beat Brady.
Yeah. How many people could say that?
Eli Manning.
Yeah, exactly. Just Eli.
Amazing.
Yeah, incredible. So you mentioned that you spent time in Philadelphia, but I know you're a Houston native.
Yes.
Right. And you are a really big Houston Astros fan. And they are also, much like the Kansas City Chiefs, they are also pretty much unstoppable when it comes to baseball.
Yeah. Right? At least recently, at least in this particular era. It did not used to be like that. And I'm old enough to understand that and remember when we were kind of bad and also just kind of mediocre and just kind of like a sometimes team or a maybe team or a shoulda, coulda, woulda team. I remember those things. And so when we finally broke through, it was like, I can't believe we did it. And then, like, the controversy happened. And it's like, oh, so that's how we did it. But then, like, when we got scapegoated for doing something that everybody was doing, I was like, well, so what? If we did it? Because, like, you're just mad that we did it, right? Like, because nobody's mad at the Red Sox. Nobody's mad at the Yankees. And nobody's mad at the Dodgers, all of whom who did it that same year, amongst the other teams that nobody's talking about. So... don't just get mad at us.
Yeah, I think that was confirmed, wasn't it?
It was confirmed.
Yeah. But yeah, it was only the Astros that they made a really big deal about. Yeah,
that's correct. Yeah. And I think the reason is because we beat those teams. We beat the Blue Bloods. We beat the teams that we were not supposed to beat, quote unquote. And as a result, they had to kind of take their anger out some kind of way.
Yeah. But I mean, you look at everything they've done ever since then, though.
Yeah.
You know, I know Zach Moore has also mentioned this a lot, too, on social media. Like, you know, look, maybe that one year, maybe. But like, look at all every single year, you know.
You can't say anything.
Yeah.
Can't say anything.
It's an incredible run.
Sustained excellence and sustained organizational excellence, which, again, something that I could not have necessarily said in earlier times when I was younger, when I was a younger person.
Right. Yeah. And you know, being a Minnesota Twins fan, I definitely know how you feel.
Yeah. So sorry, man. But thanks for Correa.
Yeah. You got our boy right. Back. Yeah. Yeah. Especially recently. Yeah.
Yes. As of this recording.
Yeah. Isn't that something?
You know, it's crazy because, like, when we, because, you know, Zach and I were talking about this, you know, way before the trade deadline. This is a possibility. And I was like, oh, that'd be kind of cool. And then it actually happens. And this city was so, it was electric. Everybody was super excited and happy. And I was, and for a second, I was like, man, why is, we are all like kind of like giddy about this. Like it's Christmas morning. And then I remembered, I was like, well, the reason is because he's one of us. Like he was our first overall pick in 2012. So we watched his career with great interest. You know, we were eagerly awaiting him to get called up. And he's one of us. Like he is us. And so that's why we're so excited, because like it's like, yeah, like we have our homegrown back.
Yeah, and that's cool. You know, we're happy for you guys, you know.
Yeah, I hate that y'all are kind of going through y'all's stuff. The business side of things messed things up for y'all, and that's unfortunate.
Yeah, and I know the team wasn't exactly performing how they were hoping it would go. Mm-hmm. We were kind of fighting to be a 500 team all year.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it, like you said, is just kind of more organizational, like business. It wasn't really so much, it had more to do with like ownership and trying to sell the team and, you know, a lot of the other not so glamorous things that come with being a sports fan.
Correct.
I think it was said that they traded 10 players at the trade deadline, which is like 40% of their roster is now gone.
Yeah. Nuts.
So yeah, they called up a lot of guys from AAA and,
Which great for them, but at the same time, it stinks that like the circumstances of their call up is what it is. And I know a little bit about that, but just in a different context. But I'm sure we'll get into that a little bit later.
Yeah, yeah, I know what you mean. And you know, obviously, you and Zach are both big Houston Astros fans, and I want to talk about you and Zach here for a hot minute.
Okay.
You know, you guys have obviously spent a lot of time on the Always Fall into Smallville podcast, and can you just quickly touch on your friendship with Zach Moore? I know you could touch on it at the top with your podcast recording back in 2012, 2013. What has it been like being friends with Zach, the pod father, all these years?
That's good. We're kind of like extensions of each other in a lot of ways. Kind of more brothers than friends at this point. We've been through a lot of stuff together, and we speak each other's language, and we also kind of speak our own language, which also kind of helps with things. And yeah, he's just a good dude. We, you know, I was his best man. It was probably one of my favorite days, and get to see that and be a part of that. So yeah, everything else is just kind of like icing on the cake.
That's awesome. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thanks.
That's amazing. That's really cool. What was it like recording the coverage for the finale episode?
It was a lot, because a lot went into that. And I know he was partly stressed trying to get everything how he wanted it to be. I know he'd been thinking about how he was going to do it for a while, but getting everybody who was involved there and the planning of trying to get everybody in one place and to do a coordinated type of, you know, big send-off also slash celebration of everything. Just a big planning of thing like is stressful as it is, but I'm glad it went as well as it did. And I'm glad he wrapped it up how he wanted to wrap it up.
Yeah, me too. You know, and I definitely understand that, you know, getting everybody together. It was in Hollywood, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's so cool. You know, you get to film the last episode of Smallville. Mm-hmm. You get coverage on it, and you're in LA, you know, and you have, you know, a big group of people there for part one, part two. Man, that's really cool.
It was a good day. It was a good day.
Right on. So actually, one of the first times I'd ever podcasted with you and podcasted in general was when Zach had me on for the season 6, episode 5, episode titled Reunion.
Yeah, the Excelsior Academy.
Yes. Yes. Which I believe that was not a plus one for episode title said in said episode.
I think so. I think so. I don't think they said it. It's funny because they say it so many other times. Like Lex mentions and name drops that school so many other times, but he didn't do it in that episode. I'm pretty sure we talked about that, how weird right. that was.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a very bizarre episode, I will admit. Yeah. But it was so fun talking with you and Zach. And I think there was at one point we were talking about like high school band and stuff like that in the middle of the episode, which you would think like, how does that tie in? But like, it
ties in.
Yeah.
It ties in.
So that was a really good fun memory of us first podcasting together. Do you have a favorite Smallville episode?
Homecoming. Yeah.
Can't go wrong with Homecoming.
No, I think, you know, Homecoming, I think it's the episode that I rewatched the most of Smallville. And I think it fulfills the promise of the premise of the show the most. And then also, I'm a sucker for It's a Wonderful Life styled and themed episodes, which that is. You know, one of my favorite episodes of Arrow is the same way. The Three Ghosts is very similar in that regard. So is the, you know, the 100th episode is also follows a similar thing. I'm a sucker for that trope. And just the fact that, like, you know, the whole show with Smallville is about, you know, Clark, you know, growing up, realizing what he's supposed to do when he grows up, right? Because, again, this is something relatable for everybody. We all go through things like we're finding out what we want to do, what we're going to be, who we're going to be, right? And he gets to see it. And he's having doubts, right? As we all do at certain turning points in our life. But he gets the reassurance that, like, he is on the right path. And the things are eventually going to work out. And he doesn't have to be so anxiety driven about his future because it's brighter than he realized.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's, you know, and those are some of the top tier Smallville episodes, you know, like those are some of the best, you know, I mean, you definitely can't go wrong there. And are way, way better than what I have previously said is my favorite episode. So
yeah. What was yours?
Season 3, episode 4, titled Slumber.
Nice.
Which I remember the first time I said that, Zach was like, whoa, 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 hot take. I got to hear why. Because like nobody in the world ever would say that, you know, like that's one of their favorite episodes, you know?
Yeah, that's funny. Well, everybody, it's so funny. Like everybody has like a sneaky favorite. They have a guilty pleasure favorite, like with everything, right? So, so there's no shame in it.
Yeah. You know, and I know it's not one of the best episodes. I will admit to that wholeheartedly. But I think it's just like the kind of like the trope of like the surrealistic aspect, the dreamlike aspect. Mm-hmm. It's always kind of drew me in, you know. And then there's obviously that, you know, iconic ending, you know, with Lana and who said anything about skinny dipping?
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe in your dreams, Clark, you know, and having like REM music the whole way through. And it's just, that was just brilliant. So
it was.
So that's mine, I guess.
What a show, Smallville. What a show.
And I know it was funny because I remember Zach was asking you or asking like, you know, what everyone on the episode was like, what was your favorite season? And you're like, if 10 was not like your season 9 or season 10 was your favorite, you're like, yeah, it's top 5.
Mm-hmm.
So what would be your favorite season of Smallville?
Favorite season?
Yes.
I think my favorite season is 3. It's like between 3 and 9 or so, I think, are my favorite seasons.
Nice.
And the funny thing is, like, both are at different, way different parts of the show. 3 is like the apex of where the show was in popularity and everything. But also, it's at the peak of early Smallville. He's still in high school, but we still have Freak of the Week. We still have, like, everybody that's involved is still heavily involved. It's not, like, cordoned off to be just, like, you know, Clark, Chloe, and maybe some other person, you know, like depending on like on the season of the interactions, everybody's still kind of interacting within the world. And then you have 9 where it's basically like Metropolis and we're basically doing Superman stories like straight up, just, he's just not in a red and blue costume. So different parts of the show, but still, those are really, really great seasons.
And I believe that season three probably has the most impactful cliffhanger season finale.
Yeah.
You know?
100%.
Yeah. Which is crazy to think about, because like season nine, I don't want to get too spoilery, but like, obviously we know how season nine, how that ends and what it sets up for the beginning of season 10. And it's like, to think that there's a season that did it better than that, yeah. You know, but everything like Lionel and Chloe and the house blowing up. I mean, that was just.
Yeah, you have that plus the Mozart Requiem going about in the background. You can't go wrong with that. It just really sets everything up perfectly. The well-placed song at the well-placed time, there's nothing better than that.
Amen. Amen to that. You know, and obviously you guys have done a lot of Smallville coverage, and you actually host a spinoff show, Always Hold On, to Arrow.
I do.
Where you guys cover all the things that make Arrow, Arrow.
That's correct. Myself and Kev. Shout out to Kev.
Yes, shout out to Kev. He is awesome.
He is awesome.
So let me ask you this. Why Arrow?
Well, throughout Arrow's run, well, actually, even before that. So when we found out that there was going to be an Arrow TV show, Green Arrow TV show, I was incredibly disappointed that it was not going to be Justin Hartley at the time, right? Because again, this show is coming off of the heels of Smallville, like right off of them. And so super disappointed that it wasn't him. But then after three episodes, I was hooked. I was like, this is, and again, I'm not trying to be hyperbolic when I say this, because it's kind of backed up. You could see a lot of it when you watch the early seasons of Arrow, especially the first two. It's like an argument can be made that was the best show on television at the time. There's an argument that can be made. And the fact that they were doing what they were doing on the CW is, especially at that particular time, incredible what they were able to do. And so it quickly became my favorite show that I look forward to every week through the ups and the downs. It was appointment TV for me at the time that it was on. In addition to, I think the only thing that was like that for me outside of Arrow was what, Game of Thrones and Mad Men. Maybe those are probably the only ones. And I didn't get into the Chicago's until my one Chicago Wednesdays until a little bit later, as being as like, you know, permanently into them as I was. But yeah, those are like the top ones for me. Those are the ones that I made the time for, and everything else kind of like I watched them when I watched them. Glee was up there at the time too. So shout out to Glee.
Interesting pick. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. but yeah, that was it. I stayed watching when famously most people nodded off on Arrow after season four or after season five or whatever season they stopped watching, as we hear about from a lot of people when they talk about Arrow. It's like, oh, I stopped watching that next season. And so I should have been keeping a tally of that, like of the seasons people got off on. But when it was announced that it was ending, I was like, well, dang. Well, that stinks. And after the final episode, Kev, slid in my DMs on Twitter and was like, hey, you want to do an Arrow podcast? I was like, sure, we can do that. And this, again, this is Arrow ended in 2020. Pre-pandemic, it ended. It was like January or like early February when it ended. And then March hit, and then the pandemic hit, and then it was like, well, I guess I should talk to Kev. We don't have anything else to do. And then that's when we started the podcast.
Yes, that's awesome. It's funny for me because like with Smallville, I started watching it right after it ended, was when I first kind of got into it.
Okay.
So it's cool that like for you guys, the show ended and you guys are like, let's podcast about it.
Yeah. It is kind of interesting how that worked. That is interesting how that worked. I never really thought about it that way.
Like you wait till like right when it's done, and then it's like, well, let's go back and cover it.
Basically, yeah. And the thing is, like, we started covering the show. We started the podcast like 6-7 months after the show ended, because it was like that summer during that time was when we started. And then, as they say, the rest is history.
Hear that? So with Always Hold On to Arrow, I noticed you guys have a slightly different structure to how you do episodes, how you plan out your coverage of Arrow, as opposed to like what Zach does with Smallville. So what exactly like was the, like your philosophy or like with your style in regards to how you go about covering each season of Arrow?
Basically, we focus more on themes and characters that are going on in the show, and we cater our episodes around that. If there's a specific episode that has a lot in it that we need to talk about, or is particularly good or particularly bad, we'll discuss that individual episode. But normally, we kind of are big picturing what's going on. And the seasons as we've gone on, because we're on season 7 now, the show has these little mini arcs through it. And they're good starting and stopping points as to like to kind of chunk episodes because they're talking about a certain type of theme and characters are going through a certain type of arc. And so we cater our episodes around that. But we'll also have specific episodes talking about just the villains or early on, like the flashbacks were a big thing in Arrow. So we have an episode talking about the flashbacks in general. Instead of spending time on like each little part that we get in an episode, we talk about all of them as they form their own type of story. We do character analysis episodes, and we also try to have some fun and do some other things as well. We have an award ceremony at the end of each season, the Ollie Awards, and we give out, we each nominate things for different categories, like, you know, MVP of the season. Our favorite one is the LVP, the least valuable player of the season, because there seems to be always somebody that like really sucks on the show for that particular season. And including, you know, like best Alicity moment. We have the Imagine Dragons Award for the whatever romantic scene happens based on the infamous and famous and iconic Imagine Dragons scene from season 1. So yeah, so we try to have some fun with it there.
That's really cool. What would you say is peak Arrow? Like, what's the best of the best? Like, which season would you say, like 1 and 2?
Yeah. 1 and 2, because even if you took out the rest, if you didn't do anything else with, if Arrow ended after seasons 1 and 2, it'd probably be the greatest TV show of ever, like of all time. Like, yeah. Greatest superhero TV show of all time, if it ended after season 2. And they kind of are on their own self-contained type of story. There's a beginning, middle, and end for everything. Everything lines up. Nothing's out of whack. It's incredible. It's really good stuff. Again, like Arrow walked so that, you know, Daredevil on Netflix years later could soar and fly. Like, we would not have that show if Arrow was not the proof of concept.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Do you feel like, in a way, Arrow was like held back or made to be less than it used to be when they introduced a lot of the other superheroes and other TV shows and kind of made it a big, like a TV universe with The Flash and Supergirl and Legends of Tomorrow and Batgirl? Do you think all of those shows and having to always do crossovers and connect with them, do you feel like that hurt Arrow as a TV show?
I'm going to say yes and no. And in the bits that it hurt it, yes, you could see which episodes they kind of weren't, they didn't have their fastball. Like, those are the ones like in and around crossover time. But then I only think it hurt it more as time went on. I think, again, the trend that started with, you know, a lot with the MCU was also going on with the Arrowverse, because they were kind of going on at the same time. And building a universe was something that was in vogue. And so when they tried to do it on TV, that raised some eyebrows, but at the same time, it was exciting because it's like, you're going to try this on TV? That's hard to do. Like, it's easier for the movies to do it. And you can make the argument that they did it better than some of the movies did. And this is from, you know, not just their own company, but others. So you can make that argument and with certain things. And then I think their focus, I think it definitely hurt in season 3, right? Because season 3 is when Flash was at season 1. And so I think that is, you can definitely make the argument that it hurt Arrow there. The first half of that season is pretty good. But then when Flash started to take off, that's when that started to help. And then season 4 was just bad all around. But then after that, they kind of realized that they needed to kind of get back to basics with Arrow. And I think they kind of righted the ship and kind of found balance by the time they got to season 5. I think it was hard for everybody involved to kind of juggle everything because they added a lot at once. So, cause like after Flash, it was immediately into Legends, and then it kind of expanded from there. And then Supergirl right after that. But by the time we got to season 5, and then Flash had a couple of seasons and Legends had one, they kind of knew how to juggle everything. And I think things were quote unquote fine for the most part. And each show had their own staff and that kind of focused on them. And then they had the crossover staff kind of like, but at the same time, I don't think it necessarily hurt. It only added things because these are things that we wanted. Like, again, as fans of these characters, we wanted to see the Flash. Like, I'm not going to sit here and be like, when I saw those first promo things, that I hated it. And I was like, this is stupid. Why are they doing this? And no, I was excited. I was like, this is everything that I wanted as a kid. You know, like to see these characters doing stuff together. And so, and they were able to deliver. So I think, you know, adding it, like it had its pros and cons. I don't think that it was overall and necessarily a bad thing. And I don't think it overall necessarily hurt it. I think there were some learning curves, and I think there are some peaks and valleys, but they managed to right the ship. And the funny thing is, Arrow is the show that after everything is said and done, fared the best out of all the Arrowverse shows, Superman and Lois excluded, because Arrow, while it had a nosedive, it picked itself back up and was able to still do some stuff. You know, Legends had to do a hard pivot in the middle of its show to become like the wacky, zany adventure show. And that's what ended up helping it and giving it its cult following. Flash never recovered from its nosedive, unfortunately, when it started so high. And then the other shows, you know, kind of struggled to gain footing. But Arrow is the one, after everything's all said and done, that fared the best.
I totally understand where you're coming from. What were your thoughts on the crossover?
The Crisis one?
Yeah, the Crisis crossover, yes.
Well, I thought it was fun. I thought it was very ambitious. I have not revisited it since it came out. I remember being super excited about it because, again, this is something... it was unprecedented to try to attempt the Crisis. And so everything that they were able to give cameo wise and all that other type of stuff, I thought was really fun. And you have to applaud the effort, I think, in making it. Could the story have been better? Yeah. But like, I liked a lot of the little moments that it gave us. It just unfortunately was no greater than the sum of those parts.
What are your thoughts on the Smallville aspect of it in the second episode?
It was just fun to see Tom again, honestly. And then, you know, I go back and forth on whether or not I'm all the way down with how they handled it, mostly because I do not like the notion of the heroes looking for retirement all the time. Like, I don't like that. It seems like every single story that is to quote unquote be taken seriously with superhero properties is the last story, or them looking for a way out, or they're out but they have to get you know roped back in, and they're cynical and jaded at the world, that type of thing. I'm tired of that. You know, the superheroes, part of, to me, what makes them interesting and what draws me to them is the fact that they have this indomitable will, and they have this indomitable conviction to persevere and keep going, and like they are Don Quixote and the impossible dream. That is what, to me, that is what it is. And so when you take that away and I constantly have them being wanting to, you know, to quit or to give up their powers, and it's like, well, I can't do this anymore. It's just like, well, that's not why you joined up. Like you're a hero because you keep going and because you persevere, because you endure. And so granted, it's the life they chose. It's a hard one, but they are the people that do that. That's why they are looked up to. And that's why they are aspirational and inspirational. So with that aspect, I don't necessarily, I'm on board all, you know, with it, but at the same time, like, you know, having watched Smallville, Clark was trying to be normal for more than 50% of that show, and was talking about and complaining about wanting to be normal. It's kind of within the character. So that's part of the reason why it's kind of like, so at this point, I'm just kind of like, well, I was glad to see Tom. I'm glad that he said yes to coming back to do this, because this is Tom pre Talkville, and he had barely just started doing conventions at that time. So at the time, it was like, well, this is great. We get to see Tom again. So that's kind of where I land.
Yeah. Yeah. I know he kind of had a stretch there after Smallville ended where he kind of wanted to distance himself from it. You know, it kind of seemed like he wanted to, mm-hmm. you know, he tried to do some, he did some movies. He was in Lucifer for one of the seasons. You know, like, I know he tried to launch his own TV show, Section 13, and that fortunately didn't come to fruition.
He's in Draft Day, speaking of another sports movie.
Draft Day, yes. Brian Drew.
Yep. He's in Draft Day where literally every portion of the cast is involved in some sort of superhero property. Hilarious.
I know. Isn't that something that Kevin Costner and
Costner, you have Jennifer Garner, Dennis Leary, Diggle's in the movie.
Diggle, yes.
It's amazing. Chadwick Boseman, Black Panther is in it. It's incredible.
Arian Foster,
real life football player.
Yes. And yet the movie still isn't all that great or memorable.
But that's why I love it.
We still watch it every year around draft time. You
that's
know?
Right.
Yeah, that's good stuff. I almost forgot about that.
Yep.
So good. Well, while we're on the topic of Arrow here, to kind of finish up on this topic, what, you know, you had mentioned that when Arrow first started, that you were kind of hoping to be Justin Hartley's show because of, you know, how popular that character was in Smallville.
Yes.
Do you have a preference between Justin Hartley's Green Arrow and Stephen Amell's Green Arrow?
Yeah, at this point, my preference would be Stephen, because he had more time. He put more into it than Justin did. And say what you will about him, but he is, at this point, the definitive one. Granted, we don't have a whole lot to go by, but he is the one. And I think there's have to be something said for that.
It's hard to argue with that.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, like, one of the criticisms of Arrow is, you know, he's just being Batman.
Right, right.
And sometimes that comment annoys me because it's like, well, I mean, the character itself was created to be just like Batman because they needed another one, which is why he's another billionaire who has a sidekick, who has a cave and a car and gadgets. And like, he has all these things, right? Like the character is that. And it's something that they make light of each time the two characters are together in any sort of circumstance, or in the comics in particular. If you watch Batman Brave and the Bold, they have this one-upsmanship type of relationship because they realize that they are very similar, right? And the only reason why Batman comes out on top in Batman Brave and the Bold is because he's Batman and it's his show. So that's part of it. And granted, also, this is also coming off the heels of the Dark Knight trilogy where everybody's trying to do it. So yeah, he is a lot similar to Batman because that's what the character is. That doesn't necessarily bother me all that much. What does bother me though sometimes about the show is that they did not go and lean into the Oliver's like politics as much. But I think I've realized that the powers that be probably said no to doing that. And they were just like, we're not going to do that on this show for whatever reason. They decided that we're not going to go down that route. And the show, interestingly enough, the show that they did allow to do that was Supergirl. But in some of those cases, that show, they did not go as hard as they probably should have. And they also were sloppier about it than I would have liked them to have been in a lot of those cases. So if there's a movie in the future that'll probably have them doing that, they'll probably lean into that more. They'll probably be having be more quippy, but you know, I'm still confused because, you know, people seem to think that those are a bad thing. But if you look at every piece of media ever made, everybody quips. So if you read a book, there's the likelihood that you will see, you know, a character say something and the writer being like, they quipped, will be present in that book. So I failed to see the problem with those types of things.
You should put that on a t-shirt, by the way.
You know, I should. Noted.
Yeah. Well, you know, you and Kev touch on some really cool stuff with the podcast. There's actually been some recent episodes that I've been listening to of a similar Green Arrow-like character, Robin Hood.
Nice.
I really enjoyed you guys' coverage of the Robin Hood movies.
That was really fun to do.
It's especially Men in Tights.
God, that movie's so funny.
Yeah, and just hearing Kev the whole time, just busting a gut was just
yes,
so much fun.
Yeah,
so,
I think that was the first time he'd seen it too. So,
yeah, yeah. So I definitely recommend if you haven't watched those movies, or if you have, you should also listen to their coverage on it because it's a lot of fun to listen to and kind of insightful as well. You know,
we try to be. We try to be.
Very cool. And I noticed that you and Kev also have this Hallmark connection.
We do have a Hallmark connection.
So what is it that you and Kev love so much about Hallmark movies?
they're just wholesome and fun, and they are part of the season. We both love Christmas, and so since those are on 24/7, like it's just kind of part of the season at this point in time, right? And especially on like a lazy day when you're not doing anything, like just pop on one of those things and just enjoy yourself. And again, they make the same movie at least 25 times a year and just change up character pairings and set locations. And I still love it all. And the thing is, it's not just me that does. There are millions of people out there who tune in to do this. This is the only reason why they're allowed to do it. And again, when people complain about things being the same and all this other stuff, like I use them as an example. They make the same movie 25 times a year and just change out the cast, and nobody has a problem with it.
Yeah. And I know I've kind of joked about the Hallmark stuff in the past, but you know, there's something to be said about its effectiveness and its staying power.
It is,
you know,
it really is. And again, the hook, like what got me hooked into them is like, you know, flipping channels and you see somebody that you recognize, like from other things. It's like, oh, they're doing a Christmas movie. I'll check it out. And then you end up watching it. And then you end up liking it. And then you see a preview for another movie that's coming on the same network. And then like it has somebody else that you recognize. It could be something that you've seen a long time ago or currently. And it's just like, oh, I'll see what they're doing and how they do this. And that's how it happened. For me, the hook was Brandon Routh.
Yeah.
That was the hook. I think, what's this guy doing here? The Nine Lives of Christmas.
Was Laura Vandervoort in one too, I think?
She's in like three.
There you go. I don't know. I've seen at least one. I think she there at the beginning of the movie and end of the movie, she was playing a song on the piano.
Yep.
I don't know the name of the movie.
I can't remember either.
It's like a decade ago. Christmas
or something like that. Who knows? But yeah, it's she's in like three. And you got the Arrowverse people all throughout that thing. Dean Cain's in like six. Erica Durant is in several. So at this point now, I'm just kind of waiting for them to put Steven and Emily in one. Like just like have this Arrow reunion on a Hallmark movie.
Yeah, there you go.
That'd be amazing.
I think Joe Theismann was in one, wasn't he?
He's in a couple.
A couple?
He is in a couple.
Wow.
But he's in a football one. We covered it on the pod because the lead actress in it, she was in Arrow and Flash.
Right. I remember her. Blonde, right? With glasses?
Yeah, Emily Kinney. Yeah. She's in of the Walking Dead fame.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, and like the main character was like a football player who was hurt, I think, right?
Yeah.
Which, you know, the Joe Theismann, you know.
Yeah, Joe Theismann played his dad.
Yeah. So there you go. Do you have any good recommendations for people if they want to watch a good Hallmark movie? Like, what are some of your favorites?
Well, The Nine Lives of Christmas. I like that. I mean, that's the one with Brandon Routh. Catch a Christmas Star is a good one. It's also kind of hard to remember some of these titles because they all blend together. but honestly, just kind of search for actors that you like, and then just start that way. So like if you like Brandon Routh, look at his things, right? And then you look at some of the actors, go down an IMDb, you know, rabbit hole, and like, you know, and look at the stars in those movies, and then and see what comes up. A lot of the premise for those movies are the same, but it's just interesting to see how they do it and who they interact with.
Awesome. Very cool. It sounds like music to my ears.
Yeah, it can be.
And speaking of, I want to switch gears here for just a minute. And okay. I want to touch on a really cool, fascinating aspect of your life that I feel like doesn't get touched on enough.
Okay.
Probably a weird way of describing it, but I want to talk about your music career. Mm-hmm. So your instrument of choice is trombone, yes?
Yes.
I also played trombone back in the day.
Yep, that's why you're cool.
It is a very cool instrument. It's a great mind to think alike.
That's right.
Amen. Very cool. So you're also an educator, mm-hmm. yes?
Yes.
So what inspired you to become a teacher?
Well, my teachers. I was very fortunate. I had a good band and, you know, secondary education, you know, middle school and high school band experience. I had really great, charismatic, interesting and good directors who ran a really good program, and that helped. And so, and then I just, you know, that's kind of the basis for everything, really. I went to school, I got to, you know, to University of Houston, I got my bachelor's degrees in music education. I wanted to kind of do that for the next generation. And that's where I started. That was my first, you know, adult job, was being a band director.
Yeah. And you are also an adjunct professor. Yes.
That's what I'm doing now. Yes.
Awesome. Very cool. Incredible. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I teach the low brass studio at the places I'm at. I teach at two junior colleges. And so I teach the low brass studio there, and I teach sections of American music and music appreciation.
That sounds like a fun class, not gonna lie.
Yeah, I try to make it fun. Sometimes the students don't seem to be having fun in the class, but I get a lot of compliments afterwards. So I guess I'm doing something right.
Yes, you are. And I also couldn't help but notice that you also won a scholarship award.
I have to think. Oh, wait, I did. But that was a long time ago. So when I was still at U of H, I got the Al Luby Endowed Scholarship there. Al Luby was a local trombone legend, but at the same time, kind of a big deal, like nationally. He was in those old CBS radio orchestras, you know, way back in the day, playing. He played on some of those old black and white cartoon recordings of a lot of different things. And he was the longtime, you know, trombone professor at U of H. And they came up with a Dowd scholarship for him. And I was one of the early recipients of that.
Awesome. Very cool. Do you have like a favorite, like a musical composer or like style of instrumental music?
That is always a hard question to answer. But as far as, because it just can be broken down in so many different ways. So I guess I'll start with composer first, is Beethoven. I fell in love with his music at an early age, in particular his piano stuff. I can't play piano for crap, but I think his stuff is gorgeous. And then that just kind of was the kind of gateway for all of his other things. And then after that, it was a gateway to everything else. You know, with large symphonic works, like with full orchestra, I love big romantic symphonies from the romantic period. I love the works of Mahler. I love, obviously, Beethoven, Shostakovich, Prokofiev, Mussorgsky, some other favorites, Saint-Saëns, Strauss. I love the like really big, heavy romantic works. I love those.
And me too. You know, I've been listening to a lot of Beethoven. Mm-hmm. I've been actually playing a lot of Beethoven for my daughter.
Smart.
So I'm trying to get her hooked on it and
yep,
whatnot, you know, at a young age. But
there you go.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of my favorites too. And
cool.
I've also been listening to some Mozart and some Bach. And
yeah, absolutely. Good love stuff. Their stuff too. So
yeah. Legends.
But yeah, for sure. But you know, the heavy romantic stuff that I'm into, especially like symphonic stuff, that's, you know, as a trombone player, that's where a lot of the meat of our repertoire comes from, especially like symphonic literature. Solo literature is a little bit different, because that could be pretty much anything in a lot of ways. And I also love a lot of chamber music as well. I love playing in brass quintet. I'm in a brass quintet. You know, I love trombone choir, trombone quartets. Something I miss doing is doing a trombone quartet. That was really fun. I haven't done that since graduate school. But yeah, I just like to play.
Awesome. Yeah. You know, and some of my favorite memories from high school was from band, you know.
Yeah.
You know, we were in marching band, and I was in pep band and jazz band and regular concert band.
Mm-hmm. All of them. Yep.
Yeah. So I definitely know. I speak in your language, if you know what I mean.
I do. Yeah. But yeah, but it's funny. They don't tell you, because now, like, you know, I'm not a band director, but I'm just, you know, I'm an adjunct professor. And then I freelance a lot. So oftentimes, like, you know, when I'm playing someplace, because I got called to play someplace, and kind of never don't know what it's going to be each time. It could be literally anything. Some of my favorite calls, like, you know, this recently, one was a jazz band gig where we played the soundtrack for Cowboy Bebop. That was really fun. with you know, the anime playing in the background. That was really cool. And then I have another fun call. I played with this group called the Illharmonic Orchestra, which does like mashups of like hip hop and classical music stuff. And so that was really fun. So again, you kind of never really know what you're going to, I don't really know ever know what I'm going to get. I don't have a big job, you know, where I just like, you know, go and play in the symphony every day. That's the ultimate goal. And I do play in a full orchestra, but it's not, you know, a big one or anything. So, when you're making it as a freelancer, you just kind of have to, you kind of got to go where the money is in a lot of cases, but sometimes that is an adventure in itself. And you can get some pretty cool calls from places.
And then you also do the theme music for the podcast as well.
I do. I've, you know, delved into arranging, and I've always liked doing that. And I've made it to where I'm semi-decent at it. It's way harder than people realize, but it's fun to do, especially when things work out and everything works out and sounds how it's supposed to. That's a very rewarding feeling. So, that's been kind of cool. The challenge though, with like, you know, coming up with these themes for all these, the podcasts is not getting sued by like copying the stuff straight up. Like, but I make it sound just enough like the things that you know what it is that you're listening to. So, that's the challenge there. But that's also part of the fun.
I know how you feel. Yeah. So let's talk about the state of the educational field for a minute here. And you're an adjunct professor. You've been working in education for a little while now. Yes?
Yes.
How do you feel about the current state of education in our country today?
Anxious? unsure, mildly scared, if I'm being honest. Yeah, I just don't, there's a lot of uncertainty in general. And, you know, in Texas, where I am, I think we're not going to feel like the full brunt of some of the things that are going on politically with education, because we have a governing body in UIL, like the University Interscholastic League. I almost said intergalactic, but that's not correct.
It sounds cool, though.
It does. So we have that. And so like a lot of the curriculum is kind of like statewide. It's mandated by the state. And so that way, everybody in the state is kind of doing the same thing at around the same time. I mean, it's organized that way, which is good, but not every state has that. And a lot, like when I was in Pennsylvania, for example, a lot of what was done with music education or arts education in general was very site-based. And so if a principal didn't want a certain thing, it just wasn't at that school. And that's kind of weird, in my opinion, but I see the logic in that, even though I might not agree. But in general, with education, it's definitely harder than it was when we were in school, especially as, you know, people that actually do it and see children on a day-to-day basis. You know, kids are relatively the same as far as like, you know, their attitudes towards, you know, being cooped up in a place all day and having to kind of do things. That part hasn't changed, but their circumstances that they're arriving to school in are completely different from what it was when we were in school. And so their point of entry is different, and the dynamics around learning are different. And so sometimes you run into things where kids don't have certain skills that you would think that they would have, and you end up having to reteach that, or, you know, and some of that could be due to technology making it so that certain skills aren't taught anymore and different skills are taught. And that becomes a challenge, and you have to be able to be adaptable more on the fly than you probably would realize. The pandemic was challenging in the sense that everything we know about education and how to do it is predicated on being face to face. And so for the first time when we were not doing that, it's hard to make sure, you know, kids are learning, because you're not there to kind of see the stuff firsthand and have a tactile relationship with it. Now, granted, there are online platforms and stuff like that, but most of that is only available to adults who, for the most part, are better about handling certain things on their own and can do an online unstructured type of class and just kind of get their work done and go about their business. But like, not a 13-year-old, you know what I mean? And so there's that aspect. And then, you know, in general, like, you know, especially with what I do, and being in the arts, we are constantly underfunded, as well as everything else, understaffed, overworked, disrespected, And we are the only, we are the only profession where it is 100% necessary and yet 100% disrespected, like at every single turn. It's the only profession where people think that they can do it better, but realize, but if they were in our position, they wouldn't last a day doing what we are doing. Like a teacher could probably do what the average person does. They would have a better time at their job for a week than they could the other way around. And people don't like that when I say that, but I don't care. And because again, like come do my job for a week and you change your tune and you probably have a little bit more respect and should have a little bit more respect for what's going on, which is also why like I also do not take the slights that we get for the breaks that teachers have from other people. It's like, oh, it must be nice to have that, that all that time off. It's just like that just shows how uneducated you are if you don't understand what's going on or why that is, or understand why it's necessary. And then just on top of everything, like there's the uncertainty of not having a Department of Education is troubling. And especially because like if the plan is to have leave it up to the states, what if the states don't have what's best for kids in mind and at heart? What if they pull, like do like the meme says, and basically are just like, well, F them kids. Like, what if that's the state's, mantra? What if they don't care? And the whole, like, I'm 100% for public education. The erosion, the subtle erosion, the subtle but like overly not subtle erosion of public education that is being pushed, I think is a detriment to kids, number one. It's also a debt. It's a detriment to communities, and it's a detriment to the adults, the teachers, the paraprofessionals, the custodial staff, and the administrators of said places who are doing so much work for communities that a lot of people wouldn't set foot in or deem necessary to do. And I don't believe in that. And so yeah, all those words that I said at the beginning, those are what I think about what's going on, and I disagree with how they are trying to treat education. And I wish that there were people that valued it better. And I think that I wish there were people that were more empathetic and understood and cared.
That is very well said. I know it was a loaded question,
Yeah.
my apologies on that, but
All good.
no, very well said. And I also work in education. I have for the past 6 years, mostly as a paraprofessional at the elementary level. And yeah, I can totally resonate with everything you're saying. A lot of it is still true, even with younger kids, older kids, sometimes a little bit different in terms of like what is actually, happening, what they're going through. But you know what? A lot of, in a lot of ways, probably more similar than you realize,
Yeah, no, there are a lot of similarities, but the only things that are kind of different with like the different age groups is just circumstances of, and that just goes with their ages. The circumstances and the challenges that you face with them are different, which is why like it's always weird like when people ask you, like I'm sure you've got this question, is like what age group do you prefer working with? And it's just like, well, like they all have their challenges. I'm not going to sit here, like the reason why I'm doing the older stuff is not because like I'm averse to, younger kids. And the same could be said for vice versa. It's just, sometimes you're kind of more naturally geared to teaching a certain, more so than another, or you might find your niche doing one group versus another. It's just how it goes. But it's not saying that, like, I'm not saying that older kids is easier than younger kids. I would never dare say that because it's not true. But also, again, they have different challenges, than the younger ones. But the thing is, like all of them, regardless of what age group, you have to like what they're expecting from you is to show up, to care, and to know what you're doing. Like that part doesn't change. Because for me, this is in education, this is going to be year 16.
Wow.
Yeah. And which is crazy to kind of think about. But again, like doing this profession, again, it's not for. And like, I obviously don't do it for the paycheck. And unfortunately, that's another thing that kind of comes with the job. And I hate the fact that like by choosing this profession, we are in a sense choosing, for lack of a better term, and excuse the hyperbole, but we're choosing poverty in a lot of ways. It's like because we're the only profession where it seems to be, it's like, yeah, you can do that. Like we need you, but we're not going to pay you appropriately for what you're job means. We're not going to have a salary that matches the need of the many for this. We're just going to pay you this because this is what we're going to do. And everybody seems to be okay with that for some reason.
Right.
And yet other things get paid way more that do way less. And so I never understood that. And I also never understood people getting upset when teachers are saying that we need to be paid more. This is like, why are you mad at me? Like, that's what I don't understand. It's like, why are you mad at us for asking to be paid a comfortable and respectable wage? Doesn't make any sense.
No, I totally feel you with that. And, you know, I mean, you know, look, you've obviously been working in education for quite a while, mm-hmm. and you are incredible at everything you do. And
I try.
You know, you should be proud of yourself, man.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Appreciate it. We try, especially like due to what I do, like I've always never not tried hard at things. And so I always just want to make sure that I'm doing that. Cause I don't ever want to do things like halfway. And whatever I'm doing, I also want to make sure that I want to do a good job at it. I don't want to be that guy. That's like a fear of mine.
No, I hear you. Yeah. And I just have one last question for you, Lance.
Mm-hmm.
If there is any message that you want to convey to our viewers and listeners today, no matter which walk of life they come from, what would you say?
I'm not sure, but I think what I could do that was kind of sum it up, I guess, in a quote, my favorite quote, and I had this on my emails, as long as there are dreamers with the courage to pursue their dreams, the world will have heroes. So take that for what you will.
Hey, it fits with the theme of this podcast, so
yeah.
I'm all for it. Very cool. Well, Lance, I can't thank you enough for joining me for this very first kickoff episode of this new podcast, Heroes of the Mediascape.
Hey, I'm honored. I'm the first one on your new thing, so thank you for having me.
Yes, you were the first person that came to my mind. I was like, I gotta talk to Lance again.
Hey, man. So happy to do it.
Yep, I like to talk to Lance a lot. No. Okay, pun intended, I guess. I'm sorry. But, you know, I was lying about one thing. I do have one more question for you.
Okay.
Where can people find you online?
You can find me at Sir Lance Laster on all of my social medias. And you can find me talking about all the things that make Arrow, Arrow on Always Hold On to Arrow. And you can find myself and Kev on Twitter at Do Not Fail Our Pod.
Perfect. Lance, once again, thanks so much for joining me. It's been an absolute blast.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.